Welcome to this third episode of the Annika Lucas podcast. This podcast was originally recorded in French. Today, we are recording this podcast in English together with Elke Adam, who will be reading the words spoken by the podcast guest Chantal Fry. And of course, I will be reading what I said in English myself. So I'm very excited today to be here. You can see that this is not a regular Zoom recording. I actually traveled very far to be here with my next guest, and I'm very proud and honored to be able to interview her. So again, I want to be able to put these podcasts out for everyone, so it would be wonderful if you could support this effort. And meanwhile, I'm very happy to introduce our guest. So I've read her book. Her name is Chantal Fry. Her book was written in German, and it was translated in English, called Speaking Out. And it is really very important. Chantal is a survivor who is very eloquent, and she has great understanding of how the network works. And I read her book myself. I learned things from it, like how the network is operating. And she has a beautiful way of mixing the very difficult experience of her life with how the network actually operates, so that you get a clear view of how it works. So I highly recommend that you read her book to learn more about SRA. Chantal, you and I have spoken before, and I'm very happy to introduce you.
Hello, Annika Lucas. I'm very happy to see you. We spoke to each other in French because my English, unfortunately, isn't very good yet. I'm still learning a lot more, but I'd rather speak French with you. I'm so glad you speak French.
Yes, well, no problem. We had started, of course, to talk in German, but for me it's a bit difficult to continue in German, so we do it in French. So thank you very much. It is a great honor for me to be able to speak with you. And I also want you to know that it is really very special, because even though you wrote this book, even though you have done interviews, and you had done some videos about what you've experienced, and you even have your own YouTube channel, don't you?
Yes.
But this is very special because you have not shown your face to the public before. This is the first time.
I made the decision not to show myself at the start when my book was published, for private reasons and, above all, for security reasons too. But now I'm showing my face. Firstly, I've been able to connect much better with people who also give me a certain security. And also on the side of my abusers, the criminals, and a number of things have happened. There are also people who have passed away and people who are very close to me and who, in fact, used to threaten me a lot.
So they're dead?
Yes, they are dead. They've passed away. And now I show myself. I show my face, and on top of that, even showing my face gives me more security. People know me. Yes, that's it.
Even when you know very well that every single thing you do puts you in danger, I also want to acknowledge the courage it takes for you to be here with me today. So thank you very much.
Thanks to you.
So I've read your book 1.5 times. I haven't had time to go through it all, but maybe we can start, because I think it's very clear how you describe the effects of your past. In your words, could you perhaps give us an idea of your life? How come you're talking now? What are you revealing, what you are revealing, and why you are now revealing what you've been through?
Yes, that's interesting, because for many, many years I didn't know. Well, I knew, but I wasn't conscious that I led a double life, in fact. But I did lead it. Of course, I had a lot of questions, but I wasn't aware of it. In fact, this double life began when I was a little girl. I don't know exactly at what age. My first, earliest memories date back maybe to 2.5 years. Maybe I was 2 or 3. I don't know exactly. And indeed, in a way, I was leading a perfectly normal life, like other children, and like later, like the other teenagers or the adults too. But alongside or in a parallel, during the night or the vacations or weekends, well, I was being abused, I was being raped, I was taking part in satanic rituals too, because I was caught in a group that actually that had the secret religion. Not everyone there, but the group I was taken to had the satanic religion in secret. So this was going on in parallel with my external life, what I call external life, my daily life, my everyday life. And given that most of the things that were happening were so traumatic, well, I had completely dissociated those traumatic parts. As I said before, I couldn't remember. I knew somewhere, but I wasn't aware of it. So I learned that. I learned to dissociate when I was very young. And I was part, and it was part of my normal life. So for me, it was perfectly normal for something to happen to me that was uncomfortable, that I dissociated. I have been able to dissociate already from a very early age. And of course, it's survival. It's a form of survival, but it was part of my daily life. That's how it was until very, very late in my life. In fact, when I realized that I was dissociating so much, I went to research my history, my roots, and what had happened. And when I noticed that, it was indeed true that the memories I had, well, I started talking about it. I said to myself, I've got to talk about it. I cannot not talk. People have to know, because I know that it's still going on today and that there are still children, teenagers, and adult people who suffer from this and who are imprisoned in these satanic or other networks.
Yes. So how did this come back to you in the first place? How did you become aware of the fact that you were dissociating? Like, how did you start asking questions like that, and how did you begin your research? And also with that, how, when you did that research, how did you know then that it was real?
Lots of questions. Yeah, well, actually, I didn't have such and such a day when I said to myself, ah, that's it, I've dissociated. Now I have to start researching. It's a process. It took several years. First, I realized that there was something wrong with me. And I was a little different from other people, or that other young women my age at the time, I thought, well, they feel a little differently than I do. And then, with regard to sexuality, I noticed that something wasn't quite right, that I wasn't enjoying it. I was reacting in a certain way. Yeah, well, not normal.
Yes.
Well, quite different from other people. And I began to wonder what was going on. So there I was, already realizing that I was different from the others and wondering why. And that was already a process for us for several years.
Realizing that you're different, that there's something not quite right.
Yes, exactly. And that I had nightmares.
So nightmares, were they in fact memories?
I think in parts, yes. But I also had nice nightmares. Well, I saw some symbols too. And still today, I don't know exactly if it was something I saw or if it was something in me, my interior life, which wanted to reveal something to me. I don't know, but I know they were my nightmares. And I still remember certain images in my memory of those nightmares, which are still in me today. That it does something to me, it affects me inside still today.
And would it be okay to maybe describe one of these images?
Yes, that's difficult. I don't know if you will understand, because for me it's a nightmare, but maybe for you not at all, because it's actually a very symbolic thing. So there's one image, for example, that's always, always come back throughout my childhood, my adolescence, and even now, when I have moments when I don't feel well, when I have something stressing me in my life or like that. It's an image that comes back to me during the night. And in fact, I saw a big, it's like a big clot of earth, a bit like a balloon. And I could see a red thread coming down from the sky. But the sky, it wasn't the sky we see outside, a blue sky like this. It was a black hole. It was dark. It was black. It was nothing. there was nothing. But there was this red thread that came out of this black hole, this nothing, and went down. I can't explain it. Appallingly slow, really. I was terrified, but I could see this red thread running down this clod of earth, and I didn't know why. I was very much afraid of this red thread, and it went down very, very, very slowly. And at one point, it was like a knife, like a knife blade, and it broke this clod of earth into two parts. And these two clods of earth would then also fall into the black hole, into this nothing. In fact, it was this black hole, this nothing, absolutely nothing, that frightened me.
So it is not a nothing, but not a peaceful nothing. It's a nothing with a threat.
Exactly, yeah. It's hard to explain, a lump of dirt, but it is.
Yes, it's a symbol, but it scared you.
Enormously, a real nightmare.
Yes, and then the question is, where does it come from?
Yes, exactly.
And how did it start with you having memories or flashbacks, as we call them?
So in fact, I got sick. I've had a lot of times when my body has reacted with pain. I got so sick, but I had pains that I was not able to explain. Well, anyway, there were always a few pains I couldn't explain to myself, or big bruises, or else swollen hands, things like that I didn't know where it came from. And these pains would not go away anymore. So I took medication, had injections and so on, but the pain just started, stayed. And finally I collapsed. It really took me all energy and I collapsed. Took all my energy and I collapsed. And then I thought, well, maybe I need a little rest. At the time, I also had little children and I worked at night and during the day. I had my young children. I thought, well, maybe I've overworked myself and I'm off. I wanted to take a 2 or 3 week vacation or something like that to get some rest. And then I had memories. They were memories coming in flashbacks and also in dreams. I had memories of rape, sexual abuse, certain tortures. I couldn't really see very much. I couldn't because I didn't know why I was getting these images, these flashbacks. I didn't know at the time what flashbacks were, but that's what I had, and I could not sleep anymore. I was all sweaty. I wake up 3 or 4 times a night. I had to change my bed. I was sweating, I was dripping, and there was so much sweat. And I started recognizing objects around me. I started seeing the bed. I started to see the room and everything. I recognized that it was in my childhood room and other room I knew well, and I was seeing a person. Sometimes I saw two. And eventually I recognized one of the people. It was my father. So just to clarify, when I talk about my father, it's the father, it's my parents. They are my educators. I call them educators because I don't think they are my real parents. I've got a backstory, but I don't know everything yet. I haven't figured it all out. But in any case, I do know they are not my real parents.
And you have a few memories around this fact, but you sense that the people who raised you, as is often done in a network, that a newborn is handed to educators who are Satanists, who keep the child, who will raise the child to introduce it into this life?
Exactly. They have their own rules for upbringing. How is it to raise children in these satanic cults?
Their own children or children that have been given to them for this education.
Exactly, yes. But in fact, that's how I got my first memories, that I was abused and mistreated by my father. And that's where it actually started, with the memories.
Yes, because the memories really were not only about incest.
It's not just incest, but it's the beginning. In the beginning, I think my soul just wanted to show me a part. I couldn't take much more. I could see, I could see insist and yes, certain other practices too that were not only insist. I already assumed that there had been other perpetrators, but I couldn't really look yet or didn't want to look either. I didn't want to.
Yes, of course. Why would you want to see it?
Right.
And this is so weird, you know, it's too extreme, it's too much, it hurts too much.
Yes, but I knew then, I always knew there was more. I knew that, I knew. But then I got so sick. For several years, I had very serious depression with also the suicidal program that had been activated. I tried to take my own life several times. I also describe this in my book. And to be brief, after 5-6 years of very serious depression, I managed to pull out of a bit and stabilized myself. Well, I didn't want to know anymore. I knew there was more, but I told myself, since I'm stable again, okay, I know there was incest. Okay, there was rape. Okay, maybe there were still other people involved, but okay, it's all in the past. And as long as I'm stable, okay. I also had children to raise, so I wanted to get back to work. I wanted to have a life.
Of course you would. And why not?
Yes, why not? Nothing wrong with that. Basically, it's clear. But I knew, I always knew from that moment on, I always knew there was more. There was more. But I didn't really know what it was yet. It had mostly to do with my father. He owned a small van, a VW, with tools because he was a mechanic at the time and I could see the door in the back of this van. And I knew that 6 months into my memory, if I'd open the door to the van, that there would be more behind that door. I knew that. But I made the decision to keep this door closed. Can we do that? Yes, we can do that.
Yes.
Yes. Whom am I trying to tell?
But it was important because I understand very well that you had children. And even if you were depressed, maybe it's better to be depressed as a mother than to be bombarded with such extreme memories. Since you knew you had to be there for them too. You know, I understand completely. And I also understand, of course, that I don't think anyone wants to go into such memories. We don't want to. You knew there was more. There was already the intuition that there was more. It's not fantasy. It's very normal. Like when we talk about what happened to us, we understand that it's very, very hard for many people to really accept because it's much the same for us. Because in the beginning, it was very hard to accept the truth for us too. We wanted to be normal.
Yes, yes.
And you had a very full life too, as a nurse and a nurse with a family.
Yes.
So nothing could be more normal. But in those days, were you also still part of it?
Unfortunately, yes. Because I was married to one of my tormentors. So he was my handler too in this satanic cult. Because my marriage had been arranged. Which I didn't know at the time. So yes, I was still being used. It had lasted a very long time.
Yes, I understand. And how... Do you know where it stopped and where you did then open the door to your father's van?
Yes, it was when my children left home. But I was, in the middle of my work. So this was my normal everyday life, but I had more time for myself. And I was also experiencing some bodily pain again at this time. For a few weeks, I was not able to work, but I had my job, which I really enjoyed. And for a few weeks, I was at home because I was sick and my children were away and had more time for myself. And in fact, I made the almost naive decision. Naive on the one hand, at that moment, I said, okay, now I'm going to open this door. And I believe in God. So I said to God like this, I said, well, okay, God, come on, I'll open this door with you together. I'll go to it with you together so I'm not alone. Come on, let's get this door open. And there it was. It was like a huge waterfall coming down on me. I couldn't have imagined what was going to happen to me then. I really couldn't. So I opened the door and bang, there's everything there is, everything that came to me. And that's crazy, isn't it? It's amazing how you can associate all these things, but when they come back, it's these images that come back. The images, they're not complete at first, but they are so clear. Yes, with all the details. Yes, with all the sense, with all the emotions.
Yeah, and then there's no doubt about it. It's very clear.
There's no doubt about the images. There's a doubt at the beginning, at least at the beginning for me, there was a doubt. I said to myself, this is not possible. I couldn't have experienced that. It's just not possible.
Yes, it's the same for me. Every time there's a new memory, at first the reaction is no, that's not possible.
Always, yes. We are always trying to find evidence to say, no, it wasn't like that. It couldn't have happened like that. Yes, that's always the first reaction. Yes, but then when I actually found the cellar, for example, that had come into my memory, it was one of the first memories I had. Related to the rituals, not related to the incest or the abuse, but related to the rituals. It was one of the cellars I was often taken to when I was a child. And then I found the cellar and this chapel where it happened.
And you knew exactly where to go?
Yes, and where.
You knew. And that place and the chapel are even pictured in your book.
Yes, I even have the photos, indeed. So I knew exactly where it was.
And how could you possibly have known that there in that spot there's a covered hole and that is where you used to enter the cellar of this church, correct?
Yes, I couldn't have known. It was, yes, I could know because I had lived it.
Exactly. And these are things which normally we don't know at all. You never think about it, do you?
Yes, that's it. No, I have other things too that aren't described in my book, where I went looking for a place. It was in fact the grave of a boy that they had killed in a ritual. And I knew exactly where in the forest where there's a big pile of stones and a stone wall. And I knew exactly how to go straight there. Just a few more meters and then there's a low wall coming into the forest, a low wall with stones. And now I have to turn right. And I was right on target. I knew exactly where I had to go.
And did you find the body?
No, I didn't find the body.
But you knew where it was.
Yes.
Because the memory was there.
Yes.
Just yet another thing. It's hard to believe for many people that so many children are killed.
Yes.
Like people always say, where do these children come from? Those children come from everywhere. And there isn't even I know it varies from country to country, but I know that in Belgium, for example, they've never had official countrywide numbers for missing children. So one would have to request the numbers from district to district. But then to get this information takes a lot of hard work and the answers are not guaranteed. I know this because Belgian journalists wrote about police investigators initially working on the Dutroux case, and they were trying to get a sense of how many children are kidnapped, for example, or have gone missing. But there was no official number. I know there are children for whom it's their own parents who give them to the network. That was my case too. And other children there that the parents knew they could potentially lose their child.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
And so, yes, I wanted to talk a little bit about things that happened to you and a bit about how it worked. Because as you describe in the book, you were taken to Belgium, too, as a little girl.
Yes.
To the Château des Amourois, the Mother of Darkness castle.
Yes, right.
And yes, You don't need to, but if you wish, could you maybe tell us a little bit about what happened there and then what happened afterwards?
Yes, exactly right. I was taken there. I must have been around 6 years old, and I had to take part in a hunt for children. It's also something you hear quite a lot, these child hunts, because around the castle, there are many forests that I don't know if it's a castle's territory. I think it may be part of the castle. I don't know exactly, but yes. In any case, I remember that there were maybe not very many, maybe about 15 children there, I think. I remember we all had to take our clothes off and we were given a pair of beige brown shoes, shoes that were for walking or running. And yes, we were told we were going to play hunting.
Naked?
Yes, naked, of course. And it was in the middle of the day. That was unusual. Yes, it was broad daylight.
Okay.
So at first I had no worries there. It wasn't during the night or like that. It was broad daylight.
Though it was not exactly a normal game, like you had been sent there. It was a summer camp?
Yes, it was a summer camp.
But then you find yourself at the Chateau des Amourois, which is an immense castle that provokes fear just by looking at it.
Yes, exactly. So we were in the forest there, and they started shooting at us with rifles and pistols. I don't know what exactly.
Do you have any sense of how many hunters there were?
No, I don't.
Just that there were shots, lots of them?
Yes, there were lots of shots, yes. And I remember the fear of that distress. And when you're a kid, you just can't realize what is going on. You can't say, oh, look out, someone's shooting at me. It could cost me my life. I've got to hide or something. No, these are not the thoughts running through your head at the time. It's just fear, but a fear that you can't describe.
Right, yeah, panic.
Panic, yes. So what do? We run.
And the shots were coming from all directions?
They came from everywhere, yes. It came from everywhere, like a hunt, you know? Not how you hear it from everywhere with the dogs and all.
Oh, there were dogs.
Yes.
And did you see anything?
What do you mean with anything?
Well, when you were running, when you were there, you were a victim. Did you see other things happening while you were running, for example?
So, well, I remember what happened to me. And I also remember what happened to another little boy my age and the other children. I have a vague, very vague memory. But what I do remember well is that afterwards, so I survived, yes.
Together with the little boy?
With the little boy, yes. So I remember afterwards seeing a pile of shoes, those beige brown shoes from before. I never saw the other children again.
But you were wounded?
I got wounded, yes.
In the leg?
Yes.
And do you have the scar?
Yes, I have the scar here in my thigh. So I got shot. And I went to hide in a hole. In this forest, there were like these holes. And it was filled with dead leaves. And in fact, I dove inside on one of those. And yes, so it was this little boy who also survived. And we had both been running on the same path. And he was the one who told me, go ahead, go hide in there.
So this was during the fall?
Actually, no, it wasn't autumn. It must have been summer. But there are still many, many leaves.
Okay, mm-hmm.
So I dove into this pile of leaves to hide. Yes, and in the end, I was injured too. So I couldn't run anymore anyway, and I stayed in that pile of leaves. I don't know exactly how long. The next memory was when I was back in the courtyard of the castle. I don't know if it was the evening or the evening after that. I don't know. I found myself in this castle courtyard and I was hurt. I was bleeding. I was in pain and I was still naked. And then, well, they saw me. And it was like I said, it was as if I had passed an exam. The exam, I passed it because I survived it. And I had found a way to survive. I don't know if they knew how I had survived, but I had survived. And that is how I passed that exam.
Yeah. And then there was this Belgian woman.
Yes, I remember her.
Yes, I've seen her as well. Do you want to reveal her name? There's no need if you don't want to.
In the book, I call her Marie de la Croix, but that's not her real name. It was Princess Stephanie Windisch-Kreitz. She was one of the people who were there.
One of the people, yes. But there weren't many there, were there?
Well, I don't remember much. I remember three people. Maybe there were still others, but these three people were the main people who were in this room.
Okay, so they talked to you as well?
Yes, they did.
So afterwards, when you and the boy who had also survived, so did they abuse both of you?
Yes.
And then afterwards they put you together?
Mm-hmm.
And then they gave you what the so-called honor?
Yes, to have an education, well, a sort of apprenticeship in their school, which was their network school, in the satanic school. Yeah, they decided there to turn me into a mother of darkness. And I also think this was connected to a wish I had already inside of me. Ever since I was a little tiny girl, I absolutely wanted to become a mother to a family. This was my great wish. And I think it's a little bit related to that. Well, I assume because they observe the nature of children and they know who they have in front of them.
Absolutely. Whereas I was a little artist, so they were going to make me an artist.
Yes, and from me, they made a mother.
Yes, but a mother of darkness. So that's the whole instinct of the mother, of the little girl who plays with dolls. That's completely perverted. So this education was the mind control?
Yes, that's it.
And did this occur in a certain place where you stayed for a certain period, or was it spread out and in different places?
So I really remember going through camps. Looking at it from the outside, I went to bike camps, sport camps, and other camps. And there was always someone from my family in these camps, because I had really a lot of family members in this satanic cult, and they were always cousins. I always had someone from the family coming along. I can't say for sure that everyone was involved. I can't say. Still not today. But I was always surrounded on all sides. So I'd go to a summer camp and I'd go and get trained somewhere else to have these training sessions, either with electroshocks or other things. There were also camps where we spent days also just playing, or I don't know, like having lunch together, having dinner together, singing songs, things like that. But all that was mind control. It was all perverted. So it was the satanic education. And the front for this was the other camp, the normal camp, such the bike camp, for example, where there were memories, where there were photos taken, where there were other children who had seen us and who had seen me. So that was the cover. In secret, we'd get taken off to other places.
Oh, but vacation in Belgium, that was also a camp. And then there were one of these three people you recognized was Renee.
Yes.
And so Renee, it was actually a year later, your family moved and you're in fact ended up living on the floor below him. Renee, who in fact was the head of those who were the adorateurs du soleil, the sun worshippers, the cult, in fact.
Yes.
And then you said that there were other members who didn't know, who weren't satanic, but there were a number of this cult, including the leader, who was actually satanic. Is that correct?
Yes, that's it. So the neighborhood where I lived in Switzerland. So at first I lived near Geneva, then we moved to the province of Bourg, and we ended in a neighborhood with a lot of people who were in this cult, the sun worshippers. And this René, he was the leader of this sun worshippers sect, who was also one of the people who had introduced me to this Mother of Darkness education, which was at the Chateau d'Amarois.
All right, all right. So yes, he educated you too. So he stayed.
He stayed, yes. He was my trainer.
And it was already there in Belgium. So that's all there. It was all planned. And so when you say mind control and bike camps, whatever camp, was it always in Switzerland or was it in other places too?
So the camps which served as a cover for the other camps, they were in Switzerland.
Okay, yeah.
But in secret, I was taken, of course, to Belgium, to the Chateau d'Amarois. I've been to Germany, too, quite often. I was also taken to the United States, all the way to the White House, which is also very hard to believe, I know.
Well, that is the truth. But you're not the only one talking about being taken to the White House. There was the Franklin case in the 80s, and anyway, in the US, it was exactly that.
Yeah, it was in the 80s when I was there, and I still remember it well.
The Bush years? What, Clinton?
Well, Clinton, I saw him later.
Okay, but it wasn't the Bush family in the presidency then?
At the time, and it was one of the memories that I wrote down in my book, it was Jimmy Carter.
Oh, okay. Who is also an abuser. All right, all right. They don't escape it, the presidents, I guess.
No.
Oh, they are all part of it, one way or another. I don't think it's possible to become presidents of the United States without actually being implicated, but that's my opinion.
It was always combined with training, but it was also because I'd been ordered to do certain things, which we always had to do anyway. There was always sex every time. Everything was combined with sex.
Yeah, I'm laughing, but it's not funny, but I'm laughing in the sense that actually, yes, any role, any person that I speak with, whatever their role was, it was always combined with sex.
Right, yes, it's crazy. But I'm starting to laugh about it too, and it's so heavy. But it, in a way, it's something so incomprehensibly stupid.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. They're all complete addicts. And in fact, because of this addiction, they all can blackmail along other things. But that's it. It's always the sex addiction. But in fact, it is stupid. It's banal. Yeah, in the end.
Yeah. There is something very banal about it. And horrible as well.
Yes, horrible. Also, with the intelligence behind it, you know, that's the reason I think it is so hard to believe it. Why is someone of such intelligence, at least judging by appearances, who's very sharp, why use that intelligence for such stupid things?
Yes, right. But this also has to do with mind control again, of course. Because always keeping the victim, with repeated trauma. And every rape is another trauma. And another, and another. So always keeping the victim down in fear, never giving them a break, never leaving a moment to spare, never a moment of sunshine. And I've always said I'm entitled to my place in the sun too, but no, you are not allowed to have your place in the sun. So you always have to be put down, and one of the ways is to rape. It is the sex and so on. That is one way.
Yes, yes. So there were several. So when you were taken there, it was part training, same for me, by the way, it was always combined. There was never just one thing. Exploitation is never just one thing. It's always several things at once. So were you talking about something specific, maybe at the White House?
Yes. So it was, how can I put it, torture sessions, right? It was not just rape, well, just in quotation marks, but there were also torture sessions. And it was underground in the basement, okay? And then during those torture sessions, they gave me orders too. And one of these orders was, well, I was taken to a military compound. And there I had to work for a person who later became very famous, was very successful in politics, and is still alive today. And I was taken to a big, big room with lots of computers. I still remember them. And they were computers that we see today. They were, I don't know, 20, 30 years ahead of where we are today. And then I had to give codes into these computers, and they were codes I had received before during the torture sessions. Because during these torture sessions, you have to imagine you end up at a certain point where you have so much pain that you become completely empty. And in those moments of emptiness, it is as if it were a blank page.
Yes.
You don't know anything anymore. You forget everything. But you are nevertheless a personality. There's someone here inside you. But this someone who is still here is someone who doesn't know anything. And then you can tell that person anything and everything. You can give them another name. You can say, for example, yes, that's your name. Or you are a man or an animal or something like that. And now we are giving you this code. And you're going to put this code into this computer in such a place. And in that moment, that is all you know, because everything else is forgotten. Everything else is hidden in the pain. And with what I knew, I had to go there and I had to enter these codes into these computers. And at that point, people would say, yes, well, that I had taken part in fighting a war with such and so, and that I was in the progress of sinking ships.
All right. So you were used, even though in a sense you didn't know anything, like as a slave.
Yes.
And you had to put these codes in that, in fact, had an extremely destructive impact?
So, if that was the truth, yes. But I had no way of knowing. Maybe it was said simply to make me feel bad, because I was a child, but old enough to know that if a ship sank, that on that ship there were people who would die. I was old enough to realize that. So if that was true, I don't know. But that's what I was told. Anyway, I was being used for something in these big computer rooms located on military bases somewhere in America. And it certainly wasn't for anything good.
And do you happen to remember how the trigger, for example, you described very well how a personality, a new personality, is created in mind control? So there's so much pain, then everything empties. And then the state is used to create a new personality. So there's always, there are also ways to actually get that personality out.
Yes, this is done with triggers. Because it's precisely in these moments of emptiness that you can program everything inside. You know, it's like a record that's completely empty. And so this is what is used afterwards to form a new personality, to form a new alter. And they use triggers. And these two are so often in relation to, I'd say, our inner personality we have, to the personality with which we are in the world. It's so also often that they observe how the person works. So what are we going to use for a trigger? And it's like a code, or it's like a button that they can press and point, there's another personality coming up, right? And then it's another button. Then when they don't want to, they put it in a back, put it back in the box and press another button. And then comes another personality. And they need that personality for military orders. This personality is needed for sex with this or that political figure. And this personality could be, still be for something else, for child trafficking or something like that. And that's how a person is programmed, like when someone programs a computer.
Yes. And do you happen to remember the trigger, for example, for this personality, which had like the codes, for example?
Yes, there are some I remember. Yes, there are, I've described them in my book.
Yeah, I would like to talk about it. I just want maybe to get one small example of how about you, for example, what was your trigger?
So a very small example, it was just a little one that had been created for me, was I play the piano and I really enjoy playing for myself. And then they fixed the trigger on the la note, so the A chord. So every time I played the piano for myself and pressed this note on this key on the piano, I went into hypnosis. So I would leave all on my own. It's clear that it's a program. And it's clear that it's something I have had to learn. But I go into hypnosis myself. So there I did it to myself. And if it happened to me, for example, with other people, and there was a male factor criminal next to me at that moment, then he could pick me up for something else.
All right.
Yes, one of the triggers too. So my parents' educators named me Liliane, which today I think has to do with the name Lily or Lilith, which is also a spirit of sexual magic. And one trigger sentence for me was, "Come, Liliane, let's sit down on the sofa." It's so banal, and it's something that happens every day. But for me, it meant, now I have to be a sex slave. And I wouldn't change in that moment into a personality, and I was the sex slave from that moment. If the abuser was next to me, then it would escalate into abuse and then rape. And I sit on the couch and let myself be raped, let myself be abused, but for me, in that persona, it was perfectly normal. If a person told me the same phrase, having no idea that this was a trigger, well, maybe they were thinking that I acted a bit weird. How does she behave now? What is she doing? But that's it. Nothing else would happen. And in time, I get out of my cage. Yes, it's like personality cages. And my everyday life would continue. That's the way it's done. And it can be really, truly banal. It's like opening the fridge or saying I'm thirsty or something like that.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, I know that a big trigger for, so you call them educators, I call them handlers, for the slaves, is mostly males over females, is trust me. And then, of course, you hear that everywhere. So there's something in your book that I often refer to. So it's just a little list, but it's actually the caller codes and what that means in the network to actually do the same thing with victims. It starts with the purple caller, which means
silence.
Yeah. Yes, you remain silent. You don't say anything. So this is a very big code. There's a lot being done to make sure we never talk.
Yes, in fact, these colors are programs. They are not just about triggers. These are either the purple program or the blue program or the green program. And it's precisely in this program that things are repeated over and over again. For example, with purple and violet, these are programs they repeat over and over again. These things often have to do with taking victims very close to death. So I don't know. Like being buried alive until you can hardly breathe anymore. And at the same moment, just before death, they take the victims out again. or else waterboarding. Things like that and torture like that. So it's something that's always and being always being repeated. And it's to keep the silence. And maybe this is all happening in a purple environment. And next, maybe they tell the kids, listen, every time you see the color purple or something like that, well, or people are wearing purple t-shirts or something, well, this is to tell you to keep quiet. You're not allowed to talk, and it's so indoctrinated. It was talking about education before, but this is doctrine. It's so indoctrinated. They were automatically react to this, that we automatically react to this, automatically. It's not something you think about anymore. So the color purple, boom, silence. And on top of that, if we've made it through this program, if they decided we had been sufficiently quiet, they'd give us something purple, often gemstones, for example, amethysts. And then you know what? The amethysts, well, they were deposited all over the place, all over the apartment, everywhere. So in fact, we entered somewhere inside in an apartment, in a house of these people of the cult. And there was always programming, always. Yes, these are also triggers at the moment. Necklaces, things like that we wore. And this programming was going, telling me, shut up, silence. It was the first program that had to be passed. And that's why I chose the color for my book. With the title Speaking Out in German, Ich Rede. So today, I do exactly the opposite.
Yes, very much. You do exactly the opposite. And I would like also to, you know, acknowledge again the courage it takes for you to talk because of everything, of course. I think it is the most important secret these days. And also the reason why the world is the way it is right now, because of this power structure that is maintained because of this satanic cult, and how we keep power is hoarded in these cults, which it is in fact the cult of the world. And with me in Belgium, what we often did was, well, we're forced to do harm and we're forced to kill. It was a big part of my mind control education in Germany. But in Belgium, it was mostly done to make us feel like abusers. We know we're abusers ourselves, so of course we're never going to talk because we're the abusers, we're the ones that are implicated.
That's right, we're victims. But at the same time, they turn us into criminals, evildoers, and that's that. And it's precisely because of this that most don't talk. Because it is true, those of us who do speak out, well, we are obliged to talk about both sides. Anyway, I feel obliged to talk about both sides, not just I've been a victim, but indeed I have had to also mistreat other people. And it is part of the evil system, the satanic system, the vicious system. The vicious circle is virtually impossible to break out of. And it's also one of the reasons why it's almost impossible to get out. And that's one of the reasons why very few people talk about it. Because whenever you start talking about it, and you know it better than anyone, you went public years ago, well, yes, we accuse ourselves as well. And we take risks. We really risk a lot.
Yeah, but you risk more than I do, because I got out at the age of 11. I was out of the network.
Yes, for me it lasted longer. So I have memories. I have had a break at 35. So today I'm 52. I had a break at 35 because I managed to separate from my husband at a time, who was also my tormentor. And then I had a break, so to speak. I didn't have to serve the cult anymore. They were watching me. They kept me in line. I had people whom I considered friends, but who in fact were there to observe me, to see if I talked about it or if I had memories. They kept me in line like that. but I wasn't raped or things like that. And myself didn't have, I didn't have to serve the cult. But later on, it started again when I did have my first memories and when I started talking about them. And then they tried again. But hey, I was already far into my memories. I was already very present. Yeah, but some things that happened were very, very difficult, because in fact, they tried to silence me.
Of course. But also, even the fact that you remember, first of all, it's not allowed. You have all this suicide programming and other programming. This is not true. The gray programming, you know, I don't know, it can't be true. That too is part of the programming. And then there is, no, I have to kill myself. You know, you have these impulses like driving the car to suddenly end your life and drive under an oncoming truck or throw yourself off the bridge or something. Impulses like that, that you completely always have to stop and stop again to see. But that's programming. Every time I have a new memory, it's part of this programming. So I have this. And then you also had people from the outside network who actually threatened you.
That's right. They threatened me directly, but also people who are close to me or who are close to me.
Oh, yes. Well, I'm sorry. That's, again, very hard. So there you have it. There's the courage again. Courage you need to talk about these things. It's not only do you speak, but you show yourself and you speak freely. You have the ability to explain too. And I find that very, very important.
Thank you.
And you've already mentioned your role in the Mother of Darkness, as the Mother of Darkness in the network. So could you explain a little? Maybe there's people who don't know exactly what it is and what it implies. Can you explain what you had to do as Mother of Darkness?
So just to introduce a little bit, in fact, I myself at first didn't know either what it was when I got those memories. And I realized that I had to be... Something doesn't work anymore, Annika.
You can just... Start again. Just start again. It's not bad. You just don't worry. It's not so bad.
Yeah, something is... I start again. Okay. So just to introduce it a little bit, in fact, I myself at first didn't know either what it was when I got those memories. And I realized that it had to be at a level that I had reached. So there are several levels. I also have a source in my book that I found. So there are several levels to reach in these satanic cults. So the Illuminati as well. And so you have the male side. And so on the male side, that there was one extra level. And then the female side. And the level I had to have reached was level 3. And this level is called Mother of Darkness. So for each level, there are other duties to do for these children or these people, and they have other powers too inside the cult. Finally, they are placed in different locations. And these Mother of Darkness, so I can only say from what I understand of what I was made to do, it was the education of children inside the satanic cult. So I had to take on the role of a mother, but in a very perverse way. So for example, what I had to do was teach them what I'd been taught myself to. For example, I had to prepare them so that they could have their bodies sexually abused later without a trace being left behind, or with as few traces as possible.
Mm-hmm. And when we talk about that, when we talk about the little girls, for example, we're talking about babies.
We are talking about babies. We are talking about newborns and small children. So we are really talking about newborns where it starts. To have things introduced into their vagina, for example, to make it spread a little faster so that the vagina gets used to it.
To having objects inside.
Yes, right. And getting bigger too, for example. In fact, what had been done to me, I also had to do to little children. And it's like a hierarchy, you know? It's the kids who are a bit older have to do it to the smaller ones and so on. So while I was doing this to the little ones, when I was maybe 10, 11, well, at the same time, I was being abused by kids who were older than me.
Who are also a little mother of darkness, but then older than you?
Exactly.
Okay.
It was a chain. So it's not just adults who are the executioners. So it's really a system in itself, in a perverse sense, always serving each other. It works like a wheel. So that is one of the things I had to do. I really had to hurt them very, very badly. And at the same time afterwards, I had to console them. And that's what brings in a level of perversity such that it causes dissonance. That's very destructive for a child who has been mistreated by someone. And at the same time, it's the same person who takes care of her afterwards. So I consoled them. There were some children I looked after later when I was a bit older. So I had bandages, I had medicine, I had ointments, like a little nurse. And I encouraged them in the sense of, go on, you are going to succeed. Of course you are going to be able to give this man a blowjob, etc. You can do it. Or, yes, you're still very small, but you're already a big girl. You've already learned a lot. I encouraged them in that way. And then, when they came back and they were hurt around the mouth or something, I nursed them back to health. So that a few days later, they could get go again. It's horrible.
Yes, of course. And you say it's very destructive for the child victims, but I think it is just as destructive for you.
Yes, yes, because I've been through exactly the same thing. So it's this dysfunctional thing that is part of the system, this education, this cycle of destruction, ultimately auto-destruction. Everyone destroys themselves afterwards. So anyway, this was my role in all of this. It was mostly with the kids. And what I also had to do there, I don't really talk about it in my book, but what I also had to do was when they were children first entered into the cult, so the newcomers.
You mean the newcomers from families?
Others, for example, children who were taken and then brought into the cult. Because we were talking about tiny babies, and there are also some who are perhaps very young who are brought into the cult. But children who were little mothers for the cult, breeders we say in English, who were pregnant and who had to give their child to the cult. So that happened to me too. I was pregnant several times and the children were taken from me and used in this cult. And I don't know where they are now.
I'm so sorry.
So kids like that, there were many of them as well, little ones. I was a nurse, a little nurse, and later too, I was a nurse in my daily life. I had to examine them and I had to do a triage. Because some children are much better at dissociating than others. So I had to run some tests on them, horrible tests to see if they dissociated quickly. And I had to make them dissociate so as to sort them. So certain babies would be good for this education, for growing up and reaching these levels. There are others who didn't fit at all, so maybe they would be sacrificed. Because there are a lot of sacrifices. There where I grew up, sacrifices for God, whom they called Satan. They made many offerings and sacrifices with little children and babies. So there I was doing the triage.
Yeah, and so in this way it is your responsibility, not theirs.
It was my responsibility. It was my own hands I had to use.
So making you guilty, guilty, guilty. So, Yeah, for silence, of course. You're never going to say that. And it's one of those things that you're never going to reveal it. It's this thing that even if you were abused yourself, it's not something you're going to reveal in public to get attention. But the things you've had to do in the network that you never ever wanted to do, like, but we did it anyway because we were under pressure, inhuman pressure. So we had to talk about it because we wanted the truth to come out. And we know that, yes, that's what I did. I was a child in duress. I had no choice in the matter. I had to do it. But it was also, and you were as well, completely indoctrinated. Maybe it was a part of you that was doing it, who was very good at doing it. Well, anyway, that's what it is for me, having had to kill. I even had a similar role for a little while. I also had to, similar to the Mother of Darkness role, I had to find young artists. That was the intention, to encourage them, to find them, to spot them, and then bring them back. So, you know, I didn't really do it because mine didn't last long. You know, it was just starting. So if I would have stayed, I'm sure it would have been much more important to bringing these young artists into, pulling them into the network in that Mother of Darkness role. So when we say Mother of Darkness and the castle of Mother of Darkness, do you think that it was called that because that's where this triage takes place?
That's a good question. I don't know why this castle is called that, but I can say indeed I'm having a revelation here. I can say indeed that I have had to do this kind of triage over there in that castle.
Right, okay. So you were there many times, often even. So interesting, mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's a castle in Belgium, and there's certain things going on there which are part of the network, but it's really specific, and it's also not happening everywhere either.
No, and besides, I even think that the title Chateau Mother of Darkness is like a kind of a cover for them, because people laugh and maybe find it a little bit, yeah, there are maybe some horrible stories there and they are legends. There are crimes happening, a bit like that. And then people don't take it seriously. I really believe that is their cover. And that is precisely because of this, and they've been able to do this for years. I'm not certain if today they are still doing these things there. I really don't know. But when I was younger, yes, I was used for this kind of things there.
All right. So thank you for bringing that up, because I know it's not easy either. And yes, these aren't easy subjects anyway. So thanks again for talking about these things. So I do have another question. It is something that you've already talked about, but I've marked up a few things that are in your book. So, of course, you do write very well about this hunt at the Chateau des Amorois, where you were with Mark, and then the role Mark later played in your life and the training. And there are very specific things, like very specific rituals, where you remember the victims very well, and you described in your book that, yes, it really was very extreme, and it's very hard to have the details of the murders of the children. And finally, it's something you've already talked about, which you also describe in the book, and that's what happened at the Sagrada Familia in Barcelona. And there you were at a certain age, I believe.
16 years.
Okay, 16. So could you talk about this experience? Could you share this experience with our audience here?
Yes, so exactly. I was 16 at the time, and that must have been at the end of my training at the Mother of Darkness. So it was a celebration, which meant it was a feast that had been organized. But at the same time, it was also an organized feast that is nicknamed Marriage with Satan. So it was like a, how can I put this into words? It was my introduction into the Senate cult. So I had succeeded. I had passed all these tests, all these different tests.
Yeah, so starting from age 6, so it was 10 years of tests.
Yes, 10 years of instruction. And so at 16, I had finished my training, and I was taken to Barcelona for, yes, I'm not even sure how or where to start because it's quite difficult. So anyway, it was the marriage with Satan.
With you? So were you the person who was celebrated there?
Right. And there was another person who had taken on the role of Satan. And he was a well-known person at that time.
Oh, was that the Austrian?
The Austrian, yes.
Yes, you named him before.
Yes, I named him in an interview. His name is Peter Alexander, a very famous person, very successful in the German-speaking countries. We were also quite close with certain members of the family, so it was someone we knew. It was organized just like a wedding, with people dressed as if for a wedding party, very well dressed. There were people there that I didn't know at all, but there were also a lot of VIPs, people we know from TV, from cinema, politics, very, very famous people.
And this was in the church itself, correct? It wasn't in the basement?
It was in the church itself. So it was in the Sagrada Familia, yes.
In the Sagrada Familia. Normally a lot of people visit and all that. So was this during the night?
It was at night, yes. I suppose, well, first of all, it was closed. And I guess sometimes these people who are so famous, they can rent the Sagrada Familia for a night like that. I don't think that should be a problem. Anyway, I don't know how it happened. I'm not the one who rented the Sagrada Familia. I imagine it must have been like that. And so it was at night, yes. And it was organized like a wedding party. And people were chatting and stuff. I overheard several conversations and recognized several people. Well, at the time, I didn't know them. I did know I was among people who were famous. Or at least, I did not know they were that famous. That I only realized many, many years later. All of a sudden, I heard my name, and I had to climb up onto the stage. Well, you know, there are a few steps that go up in this higher part where the altar is.
I see. So you went to the altar. Were you dressed in white?
No, I was dressed in red.
Oh, in red, of course.
In red, red lace. And so there was Peter Alexander who played Satan, who actually played the man I would marry at that moment. It was a role he had taken on. So he, my husband, right? He invited me to come up. And then they brought in a woman who was a little older than me, but who wore exactly the same dress. So also that red lace. And this woman, she was pregnant.
Very young then, you know, she's just a little older than you.
Maybe around 20 years old, she was pregnant. And I don't want to talk about the details. They placed her on this altar and Peter Alexander guided my hand. So that I had to, well, finally, I had to sacrifice this woman and this child.
The child that was in her belly.
Exactly.
And so all these people who were there, they were celebrating?
Yes, and this was a part of the celebration. It was all part of it. But I suppose there also people who didn't voluntarily come to this party. So there were people there, really like me too, brought there by force.
Well-known people were nevertheless forced to be there who were completely controlled. You talked a little bit about it, but others, you named several people from Hollywood and all that, and maybe not even names from the big screens, but well-known nonetheless.
Or they became famous later, because that's one thing too, isn't it? They actually make people. They promise them great success.
Okay, yeah, so that's certainly part of it. You have to first be part of it.
You must be part of it first, and then afterwards you can have great success. And you are not allowed to talk about it, because if you do, your success will be ruined. In fact, they have photos, they have films, they have everything. They've got a lot of material on everybody.
Yeah, it would be nice to get out some of that material, wouldn't it? So that we would just know everything. They generally have other more personal, more private materials on people. Whereas if they're forced, you know, like if they would be forced to leave, you know, there's several in my experience too, where they voluntarily said yes, and then they just get completely lost, and others don't really want to, but they do it anyway, but they also dissociate.
Yeah, I think there are really many who have us dissociated.
And so do you have a sense of how many people were there?
So in front of this altar, well, just below, I think there were maybe around 60. But it's quite possible that there are many more people behind them. But I mean, with the people with whom I had to do, where in the beginning I was among them and we talked and then we have a little drink and everything, I think they were about 50 or 60. And next, well, that was not only that, of course, I also experienced the horrific rape and abuse over there.
So you experienced rape there after you were married to Satan. So say you yourself then were offered so that you would be raped by the people that were guests there?
Not by all, but by some people.
On the altar, or was it more private afterwards?
No, it was on the altar. There, the woman who had just died before, so she was still there. And I was practically lying in her body because her organs had been emptied out.
Oh my God. And so the people who raped you, they liked the fact that there was a body coming from a young woman who had just been killed. And, you know, it's just like you're completely covered in blood. Like they didn't mind doing it in public like that. Like this is just so completely and utterly insane. And I could never, I don't think many people could ever understand that.
I think it's also secretly religious. So it's like in the Christian religion, you say that we die with Jesus, then resurrect with Jesus. Moreover, above, there was this Jesus on the cross. And so I think the place was really carefully chosen. And I think there's something religious about it too. So it's Christianity that's perverted at that moment.
And so Satanism at this point is people believing that Satan is actually giving them power and all the things they want in life is because of Satan?
Exactly.
And that's why they give themselves over to something like this?
I couldn't agree more, yes.
And then the more perverted the deed, the better it is for them?
So it seems to me, yes.
Because really, there's no limit here.
No. And besides, it's a bit like a contest between them. The more you are perverted, the higher you go, the higher you climb the ladder. I have examples from my father, so he always imagined something even nastier and more perverted. And if he could prove it, then he'd move up the ladder a bit, and this was also one of the systems, that the highest ranking was also one of the most perverted in the end. Anyway, afterwards, he doesn't get his own hands dirty anymore, so he tells others to do what he would like. It's like a ladder, like a contest between them.
Mm-hmm. Does this ladder only exist inside the network? Or do we see this in regular life as well?
That's something we see on the outside too.
So, for example, with your father, you have said that he was a mechanic. Has he always been a mechanic?
He remained a mechanic, but also worked in sales. But it was always in the context of mechanic.
So for him, in his outer life, there really wasn't much shown. I just want to understand how he got his power, how he felt good, you know, that he won, he succeeded. How did he feel that way? What did he use? Because you said Peter Alexander was connected to your family. Would it be one of those things? One of those things that your father, because he had done the right thing for the network, because he went so far, then when he was introduced to Peter Alexander because of this, in this sense, and then he could say that he was his friend or something like that?
I think that could have been a good reason, yes. But I can't really tell you how my father felt. I can't tell you. It's a person who I can't figure out. Seen from the outside, yes. From his outside life, it's an enigma.
But were you rich, for example? Or is that maybe not when you were little, but then afterwards, did he get rich? Was there anything like that?
So in regular life, no, he wasn't rich. And that's something that often made me think, because it doesn't make sense at all. Because a lot of people, well, normally you become rich. But later I heard rumors about him too, from some neighbors and all. And I think, yes, indeed, he had a lot of money, but he didn't spend it on us. So when I say us, I'm talking about my brothers and sisters. We have been left practically destitute. As Swiss citizens, the Swiss who are so rich, considering we were Swiss, we were practically poor compared to the other Swiss. So perhaps not compared to many other people.
So middle class.
Exactly. He must have spent his money somewhere else. And I really do think he spent it on other things. But so far, I've only heard rumors.
Anyway, inside the network, he was rewarded then, right? He was high up?
Yes, at least I think he was. But I think he still was one of the lower ranking people in the hierarchy. He was an educator for his little family. He received instructions on how to educate children in the family, in the satanic family.
And he was also an incestuous father. So while he was there, he was always covered up, like he was always protected.
We actually filed complaints against him. So yes, clearly he was protected. He was protected by the justice system, by the police and everything. So there are some things that have happened that really aren't normal, that aren't right.
And this is important because this is like the first level where one finds protection. Like in the network, in my experience, what I witnessed is that they don't spend any money unless the person there really wants it. So if they want money, if they want power, it just all depends on their desires. But if they're happy with just the protection, then that is what they can get.
Yes, and he got the protection.
Okay, and so you, the idea was that you would lead a completely normal life, like be a nurse, have a family, but you were always used as a slave. But then what happened? Is it because you weren't active and enthusiastic enough to go further in the network that you stayed that way, more like a victim? And finally, you left. Have they always sensed something inside you that you didn't really want to be a part of it? Can you talk about this?
That's a very interesting question. I know there's a part of me that's always been very rebellious. And that's something that they have tried to suppress. And I really think that this rebellious part in me, like the other parts too, by the way, because all the personalities and all the altars are really about survival. But I think this rebel altar really, really helped me to survive and helps me today too, or has helped me to get out and make the decision to take the step to say, okay, I'm going to talk about it. I don't just get out and then shut up. And then fortunately, I managed to survive, and that was that. But that's why I talk about it too, because I think it's so unfair. I can't find words. I can't think of a word.
Yes, and this has always been in you.
This has always been in me. I remember, for example, when I had to go down to the cellar to look after his children who were injured. Of course, I was taught to be Mother of Darkness, yes. That was my job, because I remember very specific moments when I said to myself, piece of shit, I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to remember every detail. And one day, you will all see, one day I'm going to tell everything. I will tell everything, and I'm going to make everything blow up. I remember having those thoughts like that.
Yes. Well, there's the match on the cover of your book.
Yeah, the matchstick, yes. I like the matchstick symbol. Because when you image a huge hole black and we light just one small match, well, you can see it. You can see it and you can see light from this match. And black is not black anymore. The black is gone. And even if it is a mass, well, this little match breaks down the black mass. And that tells something that fascinates me enormously.
Yes, you are the light. Thank you.
So are you. Two matches. It has already started a small fire. Yes, there are even more. And when you imagine it, it makes a huge fire. An immense fire. Yes, so good.
Yes. So I think that this might be a good time to end with this image of the immense fire of this light, putting the light on in the darkest facets of this world to reveal this truth, these truths that are really very hard to understand. But at the same time, it is very, very important that we absorb this truth, the truth to be able to change something. No, we can't change anything if we don't want to know.
Yes, that's it. Yes.
So I would like to thank you again 1,000 times from the bottom of my heart. And also to say that, again, still, your courage, really, I hope it is felt. It emanates from you. Your strength is felt. And I hope that your book and anything that Chantal Fry has done on YouTube and everywhere, that you will follow her so you can get more information and we can put the light everywhere. So thank you.
Thanks to you.